This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, September 16th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. KUAF is supported by Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. These daily newspapers offer local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. NWAOnline.com for more information. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the results of a new report that measures how students are affected by a trip to an art museum. Researchers from the University of Arkansas's Department of Education Reform have been working on the study, which is being published today. Plus, John Brown University takes steps toward creating a nursing program, the latest installment of Arkansongs, and more. But first, officials with the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville are assuring state lawmakers that changes have been implemented to address monetary concerns. Chancellor David Gerhart says his campus is in sound financial shape despite a state audit that cited the school's fundraising division for poor management that led to deficits.
I accept full responsibility for any and everything that happens at my campus. While I am confident I understand the basic causes as to why it happened, it is indeed my responsibility to alleviate the cause and to fix the problem.
Chancellor Gerhart made that statement Friday before the Legislative Joint Auditing Committee. He and other school officials answered lawmakers' questions concerning problems uncovered in an audit released last week that showed the university's advancement division ended the 2012 fiscal year with a $4.19 million deficit. This week, a cancer study by the American Cancer Society will take place throughout Northwest Arkansas. Keisha Pittman, director of the Northwest Arkansas chapter of the American Cancer Society, says the study begins with an online survey to get a sense of participants' medical history, lifestyle choices, and other personal history to get some baseline information for the study.
And then the day of the appointment, they'll come in, ask a couple questions that are probably things they've already answered, but what that does is just help us verify they are who they say they are. They'll take a waist measurement in centimeters, so unless you do math, you don't have to worry about that one. And then they'll take a small blood sample, which is similar to what you do for lab work. And again, that's kind of frozen off-site. That'll be a reference point for our researchers to go back to. Then after that, it's really every 2 years or so, they'll check in with you with a follow-up survey, of course, probably clarifying some things they're beginning to discover as the 20-year time frame goes on.
The study being conducted this week is the third in a series of studies by the American Cancer Society. Pittman says the first cancer prevention study, conducted in the 1950s, linked cigarette smoking to the prevalence of lung cancer. The second study provided more evidence and resulted in the Surgeon General's warning label on tobacco products, and also gave evidence linking certain types of cancer to obesity. She says this new study will take the results of those two surveys even further, with even fewer people than were previously used.
The first two surveys that we did included, the first one was right at 1 million, the second one was 1.2 million. This is a nationwide survey, so nationwide we are trying to enroll 300,000, but here in Northwest Arkansas we're looking for between 250 and 500. So to really have the opportunity to be part of a national study, it's a great privilege to have that here in our backyard in Northwest Arkansas. But what I love even more is that in the past it's taken over 1 million people to get the answers we need. And this time we're looking for 300,000. So clearly we're honing in on some very specific things that are making progress.
Although walk-ins will be accepted at the various survey locations in Northwest Arkansas, Pittman encourages people wanting to participate to register for an appointment online the day prior to the in-person survey at cps3nwark.org. For a list of survey sites and times, visit our website, ozarksatlarge.com. The University of Arkansas Center for Advanced Spatial Technology will be conducting a study of its own this week. The center is partnering with the organizing body of Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue in an attempt to get a more accurate attendance count for the festival. Jack Cothran, director of the center, says several aerial photographs will be used as part of a multi-layered data set to help get a refined count of the number of people in the area throughout the week.
The photographs will be taken from a helicopter with a standard camera, just sort of pointing it out the window, looking down. It will take several photos to cover the entire area. Those would be pieced together and, you know, map corrected so that they're all flat in the same scale and so forth. And then from those, a student can sit down, and there's an intern, I think, that the committee has hired, who will sit down and literally place a dot over every motorcycle that he or she can see. And then the number of dots are counted as he goes or she goes, and in the end we get an estimate of the number of motorcycles.
Although the technique has been used for attendance counts at other events with dense masses of people, like the 50th anniversary celebration of the March on Washington a few weeks ago, Cothran says just using aerial photographs alone won't cut it for a fluid, moving crowd like the one at Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue.
Everyone's scattered, and they're inside, they're under tents. You know, they're in bars, they're just all over the place, and they're not all in the same place at the same time. So we are not going to get a solid count of people, of attendance. You know, they estimate 200,000 or 400,000 or whatever it is. There's no way we can get that count from what we're doing. This is only going to be another data point, another bit of evidence that will help justify a count, and it will be used along with, you know, bar receipts, taxes, and so, you know, the tax receipts from the area for the time, hotel registrations, anything like that.
In addition, in-person surveys will be conducted on the ground to help further refine the data sets. Cothran says the multi-layered data collection is an experiment at this point, and exactly how the data will be assembled into an accurate attendance estimate is unknown. But he says the Center for Advanced Spatial Technology will likely partner with the Center for Business and Economic Research at the Walton College of Business to draw conclusions from the mass of data sets. Walmart has announced a sizable grant to the Northwest Arkansas Council. This morning, the retailer gave a $500,000 grant to support the council's Greater Northwest Arkansas Development Strategy. Karen Parker, senior president for the Walmart Foundation, says one of the areas of focus for the foundation's Northwest Arkansas Giving Program is to enhance the quality of life for all residents of the area.
Specifically to this grant with the Northwest Arkansas Council, you know, there are certain things such as educational improvements, you know, working with people on going back to college and getting that college education, job opportunities, working with the small business owners, and just overall increasing those available jobs in Northwest Arkansas. Healthy lifestyles, you know, we're looking at healthy nutrition, exercise, and what can we do as our part in making the lifestyle in Northwest Arkansas even healthier than it is currently.
She says the grant issued today is part of a 3-year commitment by the retailer to help improve the overall community of Northwest Arkansas by working not only with the Northwest Arkansas Council, but with other area organizations as well. As Arkansas Tech University's Ozark campus celebrates its 10th year as part of the Arkansas Tech system, the college has one more reason to celebrate. As of the school's 11th day of classes, 2,156 students were enrolled in fall classes, setting a fall enrollment record for the 9th consecutive year. According to the school, enrollment at ATU Ozark has increased 616% during the course of the past decade. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows in the 60s. Partly sunny tomorrow with a slight chance of showers and highs from 87 in Northwest Arkansas to 91 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night and a slight chance of showers with lows in the mid-60s. This is Ozarks at Large. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas discusses Governor Beebe weighing in on the teacher insurance crisis and more in his weekly business and political news recap.
Governor Mike Beebe said Wednesday that any short-term solution to a $53 million shortfall in the public school health insurance program must be tied to a long-term solution that could include reducing or repealing recently passed tax cuts. Beebe's options included reducing or halting those tax cuts approved in the recent legislative session, pulling money from other funds, increasing state control of how school districts allocate money for insurance, and reviewing the system for possible changes. Beebe did not address some legislators' suggestions to look at surplus money from the recently ended fiscal year. In a court hearing on Thursday, bank officials revealed that Pine Bluff-based Simmons First National Corporation's winning bid for Metropolitan National Bank was $53.6 million. Little Rock-based Metropolitan, whose parent company Rogers Bank Shares has been embroiled in a bankruptcy proceeding, was the focus of three bidding entities. In a conference call with analysts on Thursday afternoon, Simmons First CEO-elect George Makris said he expected the deal to close in December 2013. Makris also said Simmons expected some significant branch consolidations as a result of the deal. Thermold Magazines, a manufacturer of a variety of magazines for firearms and weapons products, announced that its U.S. headquarters will relocate to Fort Smith from North Carolina. The move will bring 65 new jobs and a $7 million investment to the Fort Smith region. Thermold Magazines began in the late 1960s as a molded plastics injection manufacturer serving the automotive industry. The company later began producing weapons magazines. Home sales in Arkansas rose 19% in July as the state's housing market continued to improve. Year-to-date, home sales are up 10.7% statewide. In the top five counties, which include the biggest markets in central and northwest Arkansas, home sales were up 21.5% in July and 15% for the year. Experts contend that slightly rising mortgage rates have encouraged more home buyers to jump into the market. FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg and Arkansas Research Alliance President and CEO Jerry Adams signed a partnership intermediary agreement that should help boost the state's tech sector. Under the agreement, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration will provide technology-related assistance to Arkansas-based research institutions and identify agency-developed technology that may be potential candidates for commercialization. The FDA's National Center for Toxicological Research near Pine Bluff will administer the program. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com. This is Ozarks at Large. While Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville is a site for entertainment, it's also a place for education. When the museum opened nearly 2 years ago, the Willard and Pat Walker Charitable Foundation established a $10 million endowment to provide school groups the necessary funds for a museum visit. The program provides schools with funding to cover the cost of substitute teachers, transportation, and lunches for participants. Anne Crabill, the museum's school and community programs manager, says when they first launched the program, they received applications for more than 30,000 students, and they had space for far fewer. During this time, she began wondering how to measure the impact these experiences would have on participants. This led her to Jay Green, professor of education reform at the University of Arkansas, who, along with other researchers, came up with a way to measure the impact of a field trip to an art museum on students.
The museum wasn't able to accommodate everyone right away, so there had to be some method of rationing access to the museum right away. So with Anne at Crystal Bridges, we took applications and then we matched applicants by their similarity in demographics. We randomly ordered those matched pairs so that the one at the top would have the first access to scheduling a visit. And then we randomly assigned within each pair which would be the treatment group and which would be the control group. So this is really kind of a set of scores of randomized experiments that are put together into one big randomized experiment. So that's technically how we pulled it off. And it was everyone eventually got to go to the museum. So we weren't denying access to the museum forever, but just delaying which groups would come later and which would come right away.
Anne says it was helpful to her because it created a way to be fair about which schools would come to the museum first. It was also beneficial because of the data collected through the research. The results are being published today and last week. Anne, Jay, and Brian Casita, research associates in the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas, stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio to discuss the project. During our conversation, Brian explained the significance of the research. It's the first large-scale randomized controlled trial designed to measure what students learned from school tours of an art museum.
Most of the existing stuff out there has been small scale and hasn't really used the type of methods that Jay and I are used to using. We really tried to focus on experiments, random assignment type studies, and that stuff in the world of cultural institutions and the studies of their effects is virtually non-existent.
So these are more like medical experiments, right, where some people by chance get a treatment and some people by chance get a control. And we know that any difference that occurs between those two groups has to be caused by the intervention and not by some pre-existing difference between those groups. Only chance distinguished between whether students got tours to go to this museum or not, and that allowed us to identify causal effects of the experience on these students. And this is an important issue in the study of cultural institutions because we have this impression that people associated with the arts are awesome. And the question is, are they awesome because awesome people are attracted to the arts, or does a cultural experience make them more awesome? And with this kind of study, we can isolate that causal effect more clearly. And as it turns out, actually, exposure to enriching cultural experiences like going to an art museum make our kids a little bit more awesome.
Well, and I can say as a museum professional, I mean, I've always known that art just makes you awesome. But writing grants to be able to try and solicit funds, there's no evidence out there. So we always inevitably state something generic like research says or, you know, researchers have found. But there's no one study that you can actually use to cite the kinds of effects that we know take place. In addition, it's, you know, a field trip can be seen as something that's just a one-time experience that doesn't have great effect. And, you know, if we've got students out there who are maybe lower performers or we believe we need to get them into, test prep mode, administrators are more inclined to say, well, we'll just forego that experience because the ramifications for not doing it are probably null.
Were you surprised to find that there wasn't more research on this, more concrete evidence of?
A little bit, although, you know, there are a lot of things that we do in schools where we don't really have any rigorous evidence for them. We just kind of think they're the thing to do. So schools, since they were created, have been interested in taking their students outside of the school to enriching experiences outside on field trips. And this has been under some pressure, though, in the last few decades from a variety of sources. Tighter budgets have forced schools to think about whether this is how they want to use their money. And so they've sometimes been cutting back on taking their students to culturally enriching activities. An increased emphasis on standardized test results has caused a shift towards test preparation and away from these kinds of enriching experiences. And some of it is that there's been a shift towards different kinds of field trips. So increasingly, schools are using their scarce field trip dollars to take their students on what are called reward trips to amusement parks, bowling alleys, shopping malls, movie theaters, as a reward for good behavior, doing well on tests. And there, you know, there may be some benefits to that, but if we're doing that instead of culturally enriching activities, we have to think about what we're losing. And so it's really important for us to try to measure what the benefits of a culturally enriching field trip are so that we would know what's lost if we stop doing it.
I think it's also not surprising that the research on it really has been thin, because I think researchers tend to focus on low-hanging fruit. And there's a lot of data out there that look at math scores and reading scores. But the data for this, we had to devise our own methods for how to measure these outcomes, because it's not collected and there isn't really an established way to collect it.
Well, the things that you looked at were critical thinking skills, historical empathy, tolerance, and the taste for consumption of art and history. How did you guys come up with that those were the four things you were going to look at? I mean, there's so much you could have measured.
Well, we did it in part because we talked with Anne about what she was trying to accomplish with the museum education program at Crystal Bridges. And these were some of the more salient things that came up. And they're also contained within the Crystal Bridges mission statement. So we knew that these were things that they saw as priorities.
And you mentioned that you had to kind of come up with your own ways to measure these things. So can you talk a little bit about what your methodology was for this research?
Sure. Well, we didn't entirely invent this from scratch. We used some other people's work in, for example, in the area of critical thinking. Dan Bowen, who is a recent graduate of our doctoral program and off at Rice University now, identified similar research that had been done at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, where they had come up with a way of a rubric of assessing critical thinking by students when discussing works of art. And so we drew upon their scale and applied it slightly differently. Instead of conversations with students, which is what they did at the Gardner Museum, we actually had students write essays in response to a new painting that they had never seen before, to see how they thought critically about that new work of art. We wanted to see if the students who had been on a field trip to an art museum could think critically about that new work better than students who had not had that experience. And so we asked students to write these essays, and we scored, using this rubric, almost 4,000 essays for this study, and used multiple coders who were all coding it blind so that we would be sure not to to accidentally cheat. And we find that if students had the experience of going on a tour, they were much better at critically thinking when analyzing a new work of art. In particular, they were much better at observing. They became more observant. They noticed things better. And so that's one of the things that students get from an art museum experience, is that they learn how to see better, how to observe better. And that's an important skill in life.
How long did it take you guys to get all of this data? Because it seems like, I mean, you've got essays being written and the kids filling out surveys and then collecting all of that. How many students participated in this?
There were nearly 11,000 students, and between Jay, Dan, and myself, we surveyed the majority of them. We drove nearly 12,000 miles?
Yep.
To do the data collection, and we visited 123 schools.
Oh, wow.
So this whole project has been almost 2 years in the making now, between design, implementation, data entry, and analysis. It's been almost a two-year effort. But nothing like it has ever been done. No one has collected data from a random assignment experiment of nearly 11,000 students, at more than 100 different schools, to see how a culturally enriching field trip, like to an art museum, affects students and their learning.
Were those all Arkansas students, or?
No.
No.
We actually had students in Missouri and Oklahoma as well.
Okay.
Students came from as far away as 5-6 hour drive to visit the museum, which meant that we were driving that far to go administer surveys to them. We went and visited them in their schools to collect data. And so we were in a lot of small towns throughout Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. And in fact, that was one of the best experiences, I think, about this whole study, was that we really got to see this state and see parts of it that we might not otherwise go to, and see a lot of really good things that were happening in places where people may not realize a lot of good things are happening. Some of these rural schools that we visited are actually doing a lot better than people think. And their kids are doing pretty well. And most importantly, from our research, we find that they benefit from a field trip at a much higher rate than more advantaged kids from a more urbanized environment. So as a general rule, disadvantaged kids were experiencing benefits that were two or three times larger than more advantaged kids. So the museum experience is particularly important for kids who begin with more disadvantages.
So you found that kids that did go to the museum had improvement in critical thinking skills, and it's the kids that were disadvantaged students, you know, got more out of it than the kids that were advantaged. What else did you guys find?
The students who went on the field trip were also, they had higher tolerance levels. They exhibited greater historical empathy. And one of our most important measures was whether or not we were creating cultural consumers. So I think that was the very first thing that Anne talked to us about when we met with her, is the idea of the museum was to build, to instill an innate desire into the students who visit the museum so they'll come back on their own in the future. And we actually, we didn't just ask them on the surveys whether or not they would come back to the museum. That was one of our measures. But we also gave all the students who participated, whether they were in the treatment group or the control group, a coupon to come back to the museum for a special exhibit that did cost money. So this was something that had value to them, and they could bring their whole family. And what we found was that the treatment group students came back at, I think, was it 18% higher than the control group students, even though they had just been to the museum. You wouldn't expect that they would necessarily have that desire to go back so quickly. So it does appear that that idea that you can inspire them to be connoisseurs and cultural consumers can be affected by a single visit to a museum.
So what kind of implications can we get out of this research? What kind of impact can this have on other schools or other museums?
I think for the museum field, this is going to be huge. Now suddenly they have rigorous research that they can cite in soliciting support for funding and policy and within their local communities. So I think it's going to be a huge benefit for them and administrators and teachers in making decisions as to whether or not they should have a field trip, and if so, what type of field trip they should have.
Yeah, I mean, it also, I think, is really important for the education policy field in that it broadens out what it is that we're trying to measure, not just math and reading skills. And by expanding what we're measuring in rigorous ways, we are able to track success that schools are producing in other types of outcomes so that we are sure to pay attention to ensuring that schools are providing quality outcomes in those other dimensions, not just math and reading, but art experiences. And also, I mean, you know, I have to say, going back to our findings, I mean, one of the more surprising findings, frankly, were the tolerance and empathy findings. We added those only in the second semester of the study because things were going so well in the first semester that we thought, what else could be happening here? What other good things might happen from going to a museum? So we added those, and a little bit to our surprise, we found that a one-hour formal tour, a half-day experience at a museum, increased students' tolerance and historical empathy. And we think it did that because a museum is a broadening experience. It takes them sometimes from a very small town and exposes them to a broader world of people, places, and ideas, and gives them some greater appreciation for that diversity. And they become slightly more tolerant and slightly more understanding of that broader world that they've now been exposed to. And so that is part of what we're doing at school, I think, is trying to cultivate in young people tolerance and appreciation for diversity. And we've discovered here that museums play an important role in achieving those ends. And I think that was just a very exciting finding.
And like Jay's saying, as far as the education policy, the typical research that's done in that field has been fairly narrow. And this is, I think, if this will go somewhere, this will have some bearing on expanding the amount of things that we're measuring, but there's more things I think that we're both interested in doing as a result of this. Jay's getting ready to start a project with Theater Squared to look at the effect of theater. We've done a project with the Walton Arts Center that we're working on, and we're even looking at establishing possibly a center at the university to look at these things over the long term.
That was Brian Casita, Research Associate in the U of A's Department of Education Reform, Jay Green, U of A Professor of Education Reform, and Ann Crayville, Crystal Bridges School and Community Programs Manager, inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. The report is out today, and you can read it at educationnext.org. More information is also available at uaedreform.org and crystalbridges.org. It is Monday, September 16th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
We're going to talk about some quiet things.
Okay.
Because our time to do that is limited.
Because I'm not very quiet?
No, because Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue starts Wednesday.
Oh, I'm with you.
So then we have to shout.
Okay.
So we're going to talk about an exhibit called Art of Cycling.
Do tell.
A month-long collaborative exhibition at the Press Room in Bentonville that celebrates cycling. I assume this is the kind on bicycles and cyclists, and includes Zeke Taylor and wonderful people like that, Jeremy Mason McGraw. There will be a public reception for the artists from 6 to 8 tomorrow.
Does it have anything to do with Fat Tire Bike Shop? Because I know they're located just down the road from them.
Because they just had the Slaughter Pen.
Oh, right. Slaughter Pen Jam and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's also a program at noon on Wednesday at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale on Depression-era quilts. One of my favorite things. It's part of the Sandwiched In Lunchtime series. And while you're there, you can also see Cover Story, a display of quilts from the Shiloh collections that have not been out on display before.
And they just had their quilt fair over the weekend.
Exactly. There's a reception at 6 o'clock on Wednesday at the Ann Kittrell Gallery in the Arkansas Union on the university campus for Craig Colarusso, whose exhibit there is called Cube Music. And Around the Block is Thursday in Bentonville. Paula Waters Jones will be the featured artist at the Norberta Philbrook Gallery, and that happens from 5 to 8 p.m.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, we turn up the volume with a new dance exercise video for breast cancer patients who used to be told don't exercise.
Just moving in your living room to music is how this whole exercise program started. Anybody can do it.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now this afternoon at 1 here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 7th annual Ozark Mountain Artists Tour will take place Friday, September 20th through Sunday the 22nd. The tour is a self-guided scenic driving tour in Newton County with stops to meet various artists and view their work in a variety of media. Maps and more information are available at ozarkmountainartists.com. Late last week, officials with John Brown University in Siloam Springs announced the college would be starting a new nursing program. But as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, much remains to be done before the program can begin training future nurses.
At its meeting last week, the Arkansas State Board of Nursing granted preliminary approval for John Brown University to begin a nursing program. Dr. Chip Pollard, president of the Siloam Springs College, says that one of the reasons for starting the nursing program at the college is to help address a shortage of highly trained nurses in Arkansas.
There's a critical need for BSN-trained nurses in the state of Arkansas. The goal, I think, is to have 40% of the nurses in the profession have BSN-trained, and I think we're at 15 or 20% in the state. And so we want to be able to help the state be able to train more BSN.
He also says that the nursing program will help meet demands by new students to the university.
It's a program that's asked about by our prospective students more than anything else that we don't have. It also fits very neatly within our mission, head, heart, and hand. We always have had a strong liberal arts program, but also professional programs, things like engineering, construction management. So nursing seems like a very natural fit as a new program in that combination of liberal arts and professional programs.
Dr. Pollard was on his way from the meeting in Little Rock with the State Nursing Board when I spoke with him. During that meeting, the board gave JBU preliminary approval for its nursing program, the first of three steps in beginning the program. Dr. Brian Gruhl, chair of the college's Natural and Health Sciences Department, says that the preliminary step is usually the more difficult of the three approvals to achieve.
As I understand it, it's been a long time since a school that didn't have any kind of nursing program in the state received approval to start a program. It's usually new programs are being started by schools that have existing programs. And so this was quite a milestone for us and you know, a long time since this has happened with the State Nursing Board.
The preliminary approval allows JBU to begin recruiting students to enroll in pre-nursing courses for the 2014 academic year. Courses in the two-year pre-nursing program will include basic science classes and core curriculum to prepare prospective nursing students for the two-year nursing program that follows. Dr. Gruhl says that before the nursing program itself can begin, initial approval will need to be granted by the State Board of Nursing. He also says that the college will need to hire a director of nursing, nursing instructors, and construct a building to house the nursing program itself. That building will include classrooms, computer lab, a teaching lab for classes like anatomy and physiology, and a simulation lab to provide an interactive nursing experience for students.
Students will work with simulators, which are actually these dummies that are actually fairly sophisticated electronic components that have a pulse and that you can treat just like a patient. It provides an experience that is very much like working with a real live patient. And so a lot of students can learn various procedures in different types of scenarios that they could use, you know, with real live patients when they have the opportunity.
Dr. Gruhl has been involved in the development of the nursing program for the past 2 years, a process which involved a feasibility study, contacts with other nursing programs in the area, and discussions with JBU alumni. He says that the nursing program will likely do more than just attract new students to the college.
When we surveyed the alumni, there were a number of alumni that mentioned that they came here and then some of them left before graduating from JBU because we didn't have a nursing program and they ended up getting their nursing degree somewhere else. But we still consider them alumni. Others knew of students that left because there wasn't a nursing program. And we certainly every year lose students right now because we don't have a nursing program.
And there are nursing programs at other Northwest Arkansas colleges. Northwest Arkansas Community College offers an associate degree in nursing, and the University of Arkansas campuses in Fayetteville and Fort Smith offer their own baccalaureate degree programs for registered nurses. But President Dr. Chip Pollard says that one characteristic will separate the program at John Brown University from the rest.
We're going to be partnering with the other programs in order to make sure that all works for everybody involved. But JBU is a precedent education. We have faith-based education, and that is attractive to a certain population of students. And I think that'll be a difference in our program that's different from the two public universities.
And Dr. Gruhl tends to agree with that notion.
That's very integral part of our institutional mission is our faith-based emphasis. And so that's really the niche that we're filling here. I mean, the students that we're going to attract are not likely to be ones that will also apply to those schools. They're going to be applying to schools that are part of the same Council of Christian Colleges and Universities that JBU is a part of.
In addition, he says that with smaller class sizes, students of JBU's nursing program will receive more personalized one-on-one interactions with instructors. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is Ozarks at Large. Landscape architect Randy Hester, professor emeritus with the University of California, Berkeley, will present the lecture, replace ecological democracy in the landscape and do it now, this afternoon at 5:30, in the Stephen L. Anderson Design Center edition of Vol Walker Hall on the University of Arkansas campus as part of this year's Faye Jones School of Architecture Lecture Series. This morning, Hester stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio and spoke with Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas.
One of your areas or one of your topics is ecological democracy. And you've mentioned democracy just, I mean, even this morning. So does that really just mean, you know, I mean, a democracy for the people, by the people? Is that essentially what you mean by ecological democracy?
Yeah, I think...
Citizens taking a hand in it?
Yeah, and we have to. I mean, you know, we all know that democracy is not like going to the Razorbacks football game in which we are spectators. It's a spectator sport. We all have to be part of the 11, or a democracy is not very strong. And I would say I'm committed to design landscape architecture, city planning, primarily focusing on making the democracy strong. I believe that the only way we can do that is to shift the focus from short-term profit, which largely, it's not just profit for corporations, it's profit for you and me. That is, what's good for me today and tomorrow is largely what's driving the democracy. And I think that we have to push it towards ecological. The democracy has to be more informed, and policy has to be more generated on the basis of ecological principles. So, to me, and Aldo Leopold said the first principle of ecology is that land is a community. And Martin Luther King Jr. said that he was cognizant that we are tied in an inescapable web of mutuality, a community. And so community then becomes the central piece, I think, of an ecological democracy. Because if the economy... I don't really know about Walmart, but I bet that Walmart is more responsible here than they are in North Carolina, because they don't have any commitment to North Carolina other than it's a place where they sell stuff, employ people, and make money. Here, this is their place.
This is their home.
This is home. And so place is important. Community is important. And I believe that we can create an ecological democracy. It will require a shift in what we think of as democracy. And I think about it in terms of, I wish that Patrick Henry had said, I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty and give me responsibility. Now, he didn't say the responsibility part.
No.
And if he had, we would have a different mindset, I think, about our democracy. We think of it as something that Thomas Jefferson and those guys gave us, but we are the only way it's going to continue to be strong. It's up to us. And we have to be responsible for it.
Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with Randy Hester, a landscape architect who engages citizens directly in the creation of their landscapes and cities. He will speak this afternoon at 5:30 on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville. Look forward to a longer interview with Hester on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Alex Hill was born April 19, 1906, in Arkansas's capital city. The Pulaski County native was musically proficient at a young age as a performer, composer, and arranger, with piano being his main instrument. As Alex Hill was coming of age, in many ways, so was jazz music.
move to one of the emerging musical genre's meccas, Chicago, proved fortuitous for young Alex Hill. Although barely into his 20s, Hill impressed Chicago tastemakers with his piano work and musical knowledge. The Arkansasian was soon writing, doing arrangements for, and playing with Ernest Punch Miller, Jimmy Wade, and Jimmy Noon. And a bit later, it would be named like King Oliver, Duke Ellington, and Fats Waller.
I'm the world's most happy creature. Tell me, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. Baby's crazy about me. Mr. Cupid was the teacher, and the reason we agree. I'm crazy about my baby. Baby's crazy about me. Parson, get that book. Hold it in your hand. Keep a steady lookout. You can understand. It's an A1 combination. Perfect he and she. Crazy about my baby. Yes, baby's crazy about me.
By the late 1920s, Alex Hill began making records as a solo artist, but this is a short-lived proposition, and after 1930, he didn't record again solo. In fact, Hill's increasing alcoholism was reducing the number of his live performances, although in other ways, his career seemed unaffected. A move to San Francisco's Bay Area saw the Little Rock native arranging for Paul Howard's Quality Serenaders heard next, and continuing to write music. Alex Hill moved across the country again to New York. Again, on the surface, things would have seemed quite rosy for Hill. To that end, he was arranging for such top bands as those led by Paul Whiteman and Duke Ellington. And perhaps more importantly, Hill was writing songs for one of the most prominent publishing houses, Mills Music Incorporated, with his compositions being picked up by such relevant jazz and pop performers of the era as King Oliver, Red Norvo, Fats Waller, and Lucky Millinder. Millinder and his band are heard next, doing the Alex Hill composition, Shout, Sister, Shout, as a vehicle for Woodruff County native Sister Rosetta Tharp. As the 1930s went on, jazz became less a fad and more of an institution, and Hill remained, as he had been, at its fore. Well, it wasn't to last. One final time, Alex Hill again moved, this time back to his Arkansas hometown to try and recover from his health problems. However, in February 1937, Hill died at his brother's home in Little Rock of tuberculosis. Little Rock's Alex Hill, pianist, famed songwriter and arranger, was only 30 years old. Here in its entirety is I'm Crazy About My Baby, written by Alex Hill of Little Rock, recorded in 1936, and performed by credited co-author Fats Waller.
I'm walking on air, for I've left all my blue days behind. I've learned how to care, and there's love, really love, on my mind. I'm the world's most happy creature. Tell me, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. Baby's crazy about me. Mr. Cupid was the teacher, and the reason we agree. I'm crazy about my baby. Baby's crazy about me. Parson, get that book. Hold it in your hand. Keep a steady lookout. You can understand. It's an A1 combination. Perfect he and she. Crazy about my baby. Yes, baby's crazy about me. Thank you. steady lookout, you can understand. They were number preacher and I'll get the preacher. Are you ready? I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Here it is, babes. Your license number is 94136.
I'm Crazy About My Baby, written by Alex Hill of Little Rock and recorded in 1936 by credited co-author Fats Waller. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
The Fort Smith Symphony's 90th anniversary season presents six concerts of classical and popular music featuring an international lineup of guest artists. Season tickets to the celebratory season are now available. Tickets and more information are available at 452-7575 or fortsmithsymphony.org. Walton Arts Center presents Onda Union Friday, October 4th, as part of the 10x10 Art Series. These musicians will travel across the globe to perform traditional folk music from Inner Mongolia, including throat singing and unusual instruments. Tickets and more information are available at waltonartscenter.com or 443-5600. If you have Alzheimer's disease or think you may have Alzheimer's disease, Health Initiatives Research is seeking participants to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of an oral study drug that may slow the progression of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. More information is available at 871-1771. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, LowGap. LowGap is in Newton County along Highway 74. Just wanted to give those people a shout-out. Got to travel through that lovely part of our listening area this weekend. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Again, thanks for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.